session of the more mandate subcommittee. However, this is not the end of the more mandates subcommittee. So we'll be starting today. We have three things that we've begun to focus on for this session on our agenda today, and we have one additional presentation. And I believe we start with Ralph Barashevsky, who's Director of the Office of Emergency Medical Service from the Department of Public Health. Raphael. Thank you and welcome.
Let me see if I can get this to work. How's that? Excellent. And it looks like I'm going to have to hold that down. Oh, and now it is. Excellent. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I appreciate the commission members' attention and focus in regard to this critical issue impacting emergency medical services in our state. I have had the opportunity to speak in front of this commission before. I believe it was last year, Representative Sayers, and you and I exchanged a little joke in regard to my supervisor, Wendy Furness, a good-natured joke. But I appreciate the opportunity to be back here. My name is Ray Barashansky. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Medical Services for the Connecticut Department of Public Health. I also had the opportunity to serve as the co-chair for the PSA Task Force. And the document that you have in front of you, or should have in front of you, speaks to two distinct different areas. First, it speaks to an overview in regard to the PSA system and the EMS system that we have in the great state of Connecticut. But then second, it moves to some task force specifics. So if acceptable to all, I'd like to discuss some of the elements, some of the specific points on that document. The primary service area, or PSA system, that we utilize in emergency medical services in the state of Connecticut has remained relatively unchanged for the last quarter of a century. It's our opinion that the system no longer consistently serves the needs of the state of Connecticut. PSA system needs to be updated for several reasons. One of them is that DPH can continue to address EMS challenges, emergency medical services challenges, as they evolve and impact our state, both today and in the future. But we want to do this while preserving the safety net features of our PSA system so we can continue to serve the residents of our state. As it stands now, the PSAs are an indefinite assignment. Also, as it stands now, and I've seen this time and again in my tenure at DPH, there are many municipalities and PSA providers who don't understand the statutes and regulations that govern emergency medical services in our state, and certainly don't understand those that govern PSAs and their specific roles and responsibilities. In speaking with the task force, I was asked to look into certain items, and I did. DPH has not revoked any PSAs within the last decade. Additionally, during that same time period, DPH has received no petitions to remove a PSA, but during that same time period, we did receive a number of concerns which were brought to the attention of DPH for technical assistance. As it stands now, DPH has a limited ability to act on anything less than an emergency situation. Our ability to act is usually predicated upon a threat to the health, safety, or welfare of citizens. What this means is it could translate into less critical issues evolving into emergency situations. As we move into the task force specifics, I'll let you know that the task force felt that allowing DPH a little more latitude and a regular review of the EMS delivery systems by DPH would be a much more effective means of addressing issues prior to them becoming emergent. As we move into the task force report, and I believe everybody has a copy of the task force report, it's voluminous but good reading. The task force met over the course of 6 months. I would be remiss if I didn't recognize the commitment and time and effort that were put in by task force members in regard to their charge. The final report which you have in front of you and its recommendations really reflect a commitment to consistent quality patient care. The recommendations that you see, and there were five recommendations, really represented a compromise between the various interests seen on the task force. The compromises take into account a lot of the strengths and weaknesses of Connecticut's current PSA system, and are really a middle-of-the-road approach at updating our PSA system. One of the charges of one of the task force missions was to do a SWOT analysis, and we did that. We did look at the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, and you'll see that in your document as well. But one of the things that should be noted and actually focused on is that the recommendations grant DPH additional flexibility when dealing with EMS agencies as well as the municipalities they serve, thus allowing for better conflict resolution and better suiting the needs of our specific communities and the people they serve. I want to touch on each one of the five recommendations very briefly. So recommendation one was changes to the local EMS plan. And what we asked for was that each municipality or authority having jurisdiction will update their EMS plan to respond to the dynamic needs of their community. And one of the things I'd ask the commission members to look at are the words dynamic needs, because some EMS systems are seeing ever-changing needs, and we need the flexibility to deal with those ever-changing needs. But we also ask that municipalities have EMS-specific EMS objectives and performance measures. We ask that the municipalities consult with the current PSA holder when updating the local EMS plan, and municipalities and PSA holders are told that they can avail themselves of the technical services that the Office of Emergency Medical Services under the Department of Public Health can offer. The last point of that recommendation, recommendation number one, is that in the event that the existing PSA holder refuses to deliver the requisite level of care identified, the municipality may petition DPH for the removal of said PSAR. The next recommendation was about DPH reviewing those local EMS plans. As it stands now, the vast majority of local EMS plans that we have seen at DPH are outdated or, even worse, non-existent. So the task force felt it was important that each EMS plan, as requested in recommendation number one, be reviewed for key elements every 5 years by OEMS, and a rating will be assigned. The ratings will be meets performance standards, exceeds performance standards, or failure to comply with performance standards. The third recommendation speaks to the sale or transfer of a PSA. Any PSA that sells or transfers its assets to another entity or more than 50% of its ownership assets or interests, will notify DPH. There's additional language that speaks to us looking at the background of the purchasing entity, the purchasing entity's compliance history, and some financial ability. But we're also going to be looking for input from impacted municipalities and sponsor hospitals prior to making a determination in regard to the sale of that PSA assignment. We also give ourselves some guidelines and dates, which says that DPH will complete its review within 45 days of receipt of the purchasing entity's application. Our fourth recommendation from the task force spoke to the removal of a PSA holder. One of the things this did was it really expanded the regulatory language specific to the removal of a PSA holder, and it really went further in depth in regard to defining the terms emergency as well as unsatisfactory performance. Again, critical elements for an EMS system to be focused on and things for OEMS to have a little more latitude in regard to. The final recommendation speaks to alternative provision of PSA responsibilities. And what this really speaks to is in the event that the updated local EMS plan demonstrates that a specific municipality is positioned to deliver EMS service or can contract for EMS service to be delivered through a responder other than the current PSA holder, DPH will develop a process to assure the matter is heard and make a determination regarding the aforementioned plan. We then give several areas whereupon a municipality can submit a modified local EMS plan. And note, as it states in your final report and in my document, this is not an all-inclusive list. So some of the reasons why a municipality could come to us in regard to alternative provision are improved patient care, more efficient EMS delivery, more efficient allocation of resources, opportunity to align with a new EMS provider better suited to meet the community's current needs, and regionalization possibilities or even response times. When making our determination, when DPH makes its determination on the disposition of this plan, DPH will consider the following factors, again, not an all-inclusive list: the impact on patient care, the local EMS plan, EMS system design, including sustainability, the impact on local, regional, and statewide EMS systems, and the recommendation from medical control and the sponsor hospitals. DPH intends to develop a thoughtful and thorough process to review individual municipal recommendations for changes in service provider. I will draw the Commission's attention to the fact that recommendation number 5 is the only recommendation that the task force failed to reach consensus on. With that in mind, and barring any questions for me from the Commission members, I'll cede the floor to the other task force members present to discuss recommendation number 5 at greater length. Representative Sayers, I just want to know if anyone has any questions for me at this time.
And on the item number 5, which there was not actual consent on that. Am I correct?
The vote was in the affirmative. There was majority, but there was not full consensus.
Okay. And does the Department of Public Health see problems with item number 5 if that were to be part of the legislation?
So at the last Moore Commission meeting that I had the opportunity to attend, you and I exchanged a good-natured joke about my supervisor, Wendy Furness. I'll similarly use this opportunity to have a good-natured joke. My supervisor once advised me that there's no such things as problems, but there are opportunities for advancement. I will tell you that, thank you, I will tell you that recommendation number 5 was by far the most discussed recommendation at the task force, and I will tell you that there will be external and internal stakeholders that I will have to rely on in order to get it done. But I will tell you that DPHOEMS can get it done.
Because Matthew Gilligan from South Windsor had testified about some issues and problems that particular town had with their the EMS provider, the current that has their PSA. And it would appear to me that had they gone through the current process with DPH, they probably could have gotten rid of that provider based on the issues that came up and the problems that they had. Would that be correct?
Speaking in a more general light, I would tell you that I believe a lot of municipalities and a lot of entities that have had specific problems in the past have been intimidated, for lack of a better term, by the process, and have in not having on the first page of my testimony, I've stated that the municipalities and some of the PSAR holders are not well versed in the statutes and regulations. And when you're not as well versed in the statutes and regulations, which we all know can be difficult to interpret and operationalize, and I will tell you that there are specific municipalities that have had issues and that have been. It's a daunting task to come to DPH and ask to have a PSA holder removed. So speaking to the specifics of Matt Galligan's situation, that's probably about as good as I can get for you.
And one of my concerns is when I look at item number 5, those that opposed it were concerned about the communities like Hartford that have many economically disadvantaged residents whom their insurance is probably Medicaid or they may not have any insurance at all. And so whoever provides the services for those, especially mostly our large cities, would be operating at a loss, and that by having communities that are more economically advantaged as well, then they sort of gain what they lose, and it balances out, and it allows us to provide services to some of those larger communities at less cost than were this to be changed, and it knocks that balance off, there would be increased cost to those communities. Would you comment on that, please?
I'm unsure I could appropriately comment on that, Representative Sayers, except to say that I've heard similar concern, and I understand that practice of the same entity serving the community, both sides of the communities that you mentioned, I've heard the same concern. Speaking directly to it, I probably couldn't offer much of a perspective on it. However, I actually believe that one of the two one of the two people who are speaking after me could probably do somewhat of a better job than I could in that regard, speaking to the cost factor.
And one of the things that I see is the proponents of recommendation number 5 is that if they had to surrender that PSA, they could do that. And it sounds to me that if I had a friend that had an ambulance services and I was the first selectman of the town, I could say, I'm going to get rid of that old one and have my good friend have the service because I know they do a good job and it helps out. He lives in the community and it helps out people in the community and for all these good reasons. But there's not any reason other than that for making changes in the service. And I think that in the long run, I have a concern that that could be problematic.
Thank you. Similar concern was actually verbalized at some of the beginning, the first PSA task force meetings about that specific example occurring. Speaking to that, when we look at recommendation number 5, it actually states that DPH will develop a process to ensure the matter is heard. And then it goes further to say that some of the things that we'll look at are the impact on patient care, system design, impact on the local, regional, and statewide, the local EMS plan, and the recommendation. So when we look at these factors, and again, that list is not all inclusive. So when we look at those factors, one of the things we'll be looking at is if Jimmy wants Joey to provide his ambulance service, as opposed to if Jimmy wants a thoughtful consideration of the process, the EMS system, the patient care delivery, et cetera, et cetera. I could go further. And yes, that is one of the back burner issues that we will also be looking at as we at DPH develop said process. It's not off of our radar screen, Representative.
Thank you. I want to open it up, Bob Levinera, followed by Fillmore McPherson.
Thank you. Just a couple background questions. How often did the task force meet, or when did it start meeting?
Way too often. I'm sorry, excuse me. We began meeting in the beginning of September, and we began meeting, I believe it was every 2 weeks. However, there were certain weeks where we met every week, and there were actually a few meetings that went, I believe there was a meeting that went 8 hours. But each meeting was, thank you for laughing, sir. But each meeting was at least an hour and a half to 2 hours long.
So it's fair to say that this is a product of a deliberative process since September, at least. My question is, I had to leave the room. Recommendation number 5 was approved by a majority of the people on the task force. Is that correct?
That's affirmative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd have one question and then a couple of comments. The question has to do, I'm looking at number 5, recommendation number 5, and some of the words in the reasons in a couple of the bullets use the word efficient delivery, efficient allocation of resources. Hopefully that would include a means of cost. In other words, you can always, if you throw truckloads of money at something, you can always increase the service, et cetera. I'm sure if you had a paramedic station on every other street corner, you could deliver wonderful service. So I'm hoping that the overall cost of a program is something that's being that would be allowable under the efficiency term here.
Certainly we would be looking at some of the economic realities of the EMS system and how they would be impacting both the existing EMS provider as well as future providers. And you make a good point in regard to it's simply not feasible to have a paramedic on every street corner. However, a local EMS plan that speaks to a more efficient EMS delivery system or more efficient allocation of resources, those certainly would be things we're looking at. And dynamically intertwined with those clearly would be some cost issues.
Yeah, thank you. I speak to that because in our own town we're debating whether to add an additional paramedic, which may help in something like 15 to 20 cases per year. So, it, you know, at the cost of $150,000 or so. So at some point, you do need to look at some of those trade-offs. Madam Chair, then a couple of comments. In particular, your last comment about Joey giving the contract to Leo, I think that's right on, that we do need to not do that. That is a bane on all public services and needs to be guarded against at the local level, the state level, whatever it is. You know, the political favoritism for contracts should not be encouraged or allowed. So I agree with your comment on that one. The other comment has to do with the earlier discussion about having, if an EMS provider had multiple towns, some of which would then subsidize the operation of, let's call it a spade, you know, the bigger cities and so forth. I think in a broader sense, that comment goes to the heart of why we are meeting here today, because that what you described in your comment is nothing more than a backdoor mandate on the towns that are paying more in order to subsidize. Not to say that we shouldn't have the services in the big cities that that were mentioned, but that should be coming out of the state legislature and part of the budget. That if a city X needs extra dollars to fund these kinds of services in some of the lower income neighborhoods, that is the state's decision and quite probably a good one, but then they pay for it. Don't farm it back out as a backdoor mandate to other cities and towns. And I think that's really what we're all about here in this committee. Thank you.
Mr. McPherson, if the state, which has a set pot of money, were to do that and took it from Madison's allocation, would that be all right?
Given that our allocation is minuscule to start with, I think we could work out a deal.
And that is the problem. The state has the same problem that municipalities have, in that we have a limited amount of money and we can only spread it so far. But I do appreciate what you're saying, and yeah. I know it is very difficult.
And just as a quick comeback, I think, not without a lot of disagreement, but the state needs to then bite the bullet and say, okay, I'm going to raise the income tax or whatever else. And you get thrown out of the rocks thrown at you for the cost that you incur.
And I'm not planning on raising any income tax, just so you know. any additional questions? Anybody? Yes, Mr. Paul.
I just want to ask the same question or similar question than Bob did, but recommendation 5 was voted on unanimously, and it allows for the communities to, in essence, I'm going to really simplify this, I guess, in essence, to select their PSA.
So,
or provide emergency services.
I understand the question. By points of just two quick clarifications, it was not unanimous. The
correct
vote for recommendation number 5 was, I believe, 8-7. I could be incorrect, but the document in front of you could confirm that, the PSA task force final report. No, and in regard to the second part of your question, what it allows the municipalities to do is more latitude in modifying their local EMS plan to reflect a new provider, a provider who's not currently providing emergency medical services for their municipality, and then to come to DPH with a rationale mm-hmm. for the utilization of that new provider, for the utilization, for the rationale of an alternative provision for PSA responsibilities. Then it also gives DPH the latitude to develop a process in which to determine whether that provider will be able to provide a better, different level of care than the provider who currently has the PSA.
Okay.
I apologize for speaking in bureaucratese. Unfortunately, I'm just trying to give you the best possible information based on the PSA.
Well, you had a very difficult task here, and I can tell that this recommendation 5 must have caused a great deal of debate. But it seems to me, if it was approved, does it have to be a unanimous vote to be implemented, or recommended by the task force?
May I?
Go right ahead.
The vote was 8-7. The majority of the people at the meeting voted for it. There are 3 ways of looking at the recommendation. There's one side, the other side, which you'll be hearing, and then there's the DPH way, which, as I've just stated, we look at this as an opportunity to take a system which is dated,
correct,
and modernize it and update it. Not every municipality is going to jump in and say, modernize me, update me.
Well, that's the point I was leading up to, sir, is that there may not be a majority of municipalities who might want to jump up and say, let's modernize. They may want to, many of the municipalities may want to stay right in the system that they're in, because they may be happy with the services. But I would suspect that there might be more than the South Windsor incident. Spatterings maybe throughout the state that might want to take a look at this opportunity and may want to, and using your terms, to modernize it. So I just wanted to have that comment and ask you those questions, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Ray, if I could take Mr. McPherson's last comment a little bit further about adding more paramedic services and making that decision. You know, I think that's a problem for many of the towns, because adding paramedic services is a big issue today, and so many of the calls require those paramedic services, and towns have to start thinking about how they can best provide that, and sometimes that is a bigger problem than the whole provision of emergency services. Does that lend itself to looking at a regional way of providing that paramedic services at all that might be much more helpful to towns? Because usually with the paramedic services, there's also an increased cost because they're usually paid services.
The regional realities of it I probably cannot speak to, but I will tell you that, yes, the provision of paramedic level service is a lot more expensive than the provision of basic life support level service. You are correct in that regard. Whether towns would choose to, for lack of a better term, band together if they wanted to modify or modernize or update their PSA provider, that would really sit on the shoulders of the municipality. But it is a possibility and a potential.
Thank you, because I think that's something important for us to look at, because I know that that's a big issue for a lot of towns to make that decision. Yes, Mr. McPherson.
Just to comment on that, Madam Chair, I see how that works in a couple of places. In our town, we have our own ambulance service with paramedics on duty serving our town. However, there are mutual aid agreements with all the surrounding towns. A town next door to us is a member of a much larger group. And anecdotally, I've had friends in that town say that if they get have some big problem, they're going to bundle in the car and drive over the town line, because it takes so long for this large group to send somebody from 15 miles away or whatever. So there are pluses and minuses. Regionalization is one of those things that sounds wonderful, but it's all in the details.
Right, and I think that maybe for future, as part of this, is something that we might want to think about for a future discussion, not for this year, obviously, because we don't have the time to do that now. But going forward, because the more commission will continue, and so I think that is something that really and truly that we need to look at, because I think it might be helpful, because a lot of towns, I'm sure, are are juggling with that same decision that you're trying to make. How do we? What's the best way to go about this, and what exactly meets the town's needs at the least cost? As we try and save, all of us try and save some pennies here and there. So thank you. Michael Chris, followed by Representative Castro.
Just a quick question, and maybe this has been discussed before, but the PSA ownership would still remain in the service provider's hands. And if that service provider was to say, such as our town has a volunteer service provider, if that provider was to have no more volunteers and all of a sudden cannot provide the services, the town would not own the PSA, they would own the PSA. And I think one of the concerns that came up in one of the other meetings, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the cost of getting the PSA back to go with a different provider would be exorbitant.
And I don't have an answer to that, so I'm going to let Ray answer that, because supposedly that PSA doesn't cost anything, but it does have value.
That was very well stated, Representative. Thank you. And thank you for the question, sir. Yes, the PSA would remain with the PSA would remain with the EMS entity. Speaking to that specific example that you brought up, I think that it's very interesting that some of the discussion points today have focused on EMS agencies and relationships with the municipalities they serve. And some of the questions have come up in that regard, and some of the discussion points both in the task force and in my specific testimony speak to that. One of the things that we consistently touched on at the task force was the need for municipalities and PSA holders to understand that OEMS has a certain amount of technical assistance that we're willing to assist with, to come out to your municipality, say, or to meet with your PSA holder and municipality. I would never want to see it come to what you just said. Suddenly the last volunteer, like, close the door on your way out, shut the light on your way out. I don't want to see that occur. Nobody sitting around this table, nor in the audience, wants to see that occur. So I think it's mentioned at least two or three times in the final report about the technical assistance that OEMS is willing to provide. We would like to head off a situation like that before it came to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nicastro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your packet that you presented us with today, item 6, municipalities routinely go out to bid for proposals to determine the best way to provide a variety of services as a matter of best practice. EMS should be no exception. Question as an example now, just to make a point. I live in Bristol. Bristol has Bristol Hospital. Okay, and the ambulance comes out of there. Would it be advantageous for us to go out to bid when we have a hospital in our town with an ambulance service coming right out of the hospital?
I would love to be able to discuss what you just brought up. However, that's not in the testimony that I offered you. It's probably from one of the other people who plans to testify after me.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for understanding.
Ben.
Thank you. Looking at the some of the advocates' letters that we have, mm-hmm. There seems to be a little bit of disagreement or spin on the impact of number 5. So I'd like to ask you, looking at the in the packet page, I guess page 8, it describing the process. So if a municipality, and I understand under number 5, they are able to seek your review mm-hmm. more easily than they were now. But in terms of the standards that DPH would apply, is that, and can you go into a little more detail? I mean, what is your flexibility as DPH to decide or not decide whether there should be a shift in?
Okay, clearly we have different page 8s.
Okay, well, maybe, is it 18? Oh, that's 18. You're right. I'm sorry. 18.
No problem. I understand.
The vertical numbering confused me.
No problem whatsoever, one, sir.
You know. Right. So it talks about a municipality may submit for consideration for various reasons.
No, I understand.
But then it's what you do. It's so not just pick Joey.
Very
you're,
good.
You're in the middle.
So we are. And one of the charges that the task force has left DPH with is the development of a process to assure that this is heard and heard appropriately, and therefore determinations made on the aforementioned plan. We're blessed in the state of Connecticut to have a lot of EMS system experts. I won't go into specifics, but I will tell you that there are a lot of people that I've had the opportunity to learn a lot from in the last year and a half. And my professional game plan in regard to that specific comment, statement, as well as the rest of that page, is to get input from both internal and external stakeholders as to the most appropriate way to gauge those local EMS plans, to look at the most important processes, performance measures, et cetera, and then to evaluate those plans based on that. And everyone good?
Got it.
Okay. And then looking at not only the two lists that we have, the list where the local EMS plan can be pushed out to DPH, that's that first list, but also that second list, those are simply representative examples. So we want to look at clinical measures. We want to look at system measures. We want to look at performance measures. We do want to look at the total package so that we don't have, as I said before, Jimmy giving Joey the ambulance service just because it's there. We want to look at the word that we used on the task force and that we codified is the word process, and that's what we plan to do, develop a process. We don't plan on doing it in a bubble. I won't be doing it alone over at 410 Capitol. We will be doing it with both internal and external stakeholders to assure that we have a best practice that we're developing.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And our next speaker is Mary Ellen Harper, who's Director of Fire and Rescue Services in Farmington.
Thank you very much to the commission members. I appreciate your time and attention.
Good afternoon. I wanted to thank you all for the opportunity to offer testimony in regards to the final report of the EMS PSA Task Force. Just as a little introduction, I did serve as the co-chair of the task force, and I'm also the director of fire and rescue services for the town of Farmington Fire Department. That's a position that I've held for the last 11 years, and I've been employed in that town for the last 17 years. Beyond that, I've been involved in emergency services here in Connecticut for the last 22 years, both working and volunteering in the communities of Bloomfield, West Haven, Farmington, and Colchester. I'm a certified emergency medical technician and also an emergency medical services instructor. And if implemented, the five recommendations in the report before you would literally be the most significant forward progress that Connecticut's EMS system has seen in my entire lifetime. The PSA system, as we look at it now, is almost 40 years old. It needs to be updated to incorporate the elements of best practice, transparency, home rule, and all of those are good basic foundations of public policy. Recommendations 1 through 4 in that report or common sense, and quite honestly, they should have been implemented many, many years ago. They're unanimous, and they would be a home run for the legislature if you were to go ahead and get them implemented this session. It's really a no-brainer, and we just need to do that and get it done because it's past due. Recommendation number 5 is really the point that I want to speak to because it seems like there's the most questions for that, and that's called the alternative provision of PSA responsibilities, and it allows the municipalities the right to submit a local EMS plan to DPH for consideration of somebody to provide the service other than the person that's currently in play. Please realize that that doesn't offer a guarantee. We're not saying it's going to go. It's saying we have the opportunity to have our day in court and to have our issues heard. And that's all we're asking for is a right to due process. Recommendation number 5 does take into account almost all of the arguments that have been used against allowing for change to the PSA system. Everything that we've heard about cost effectiveness, system stability, medical control, local EMS plans, all those are things that DPH would need to look at as part of the formal hearing and that process that Director Barashansky alluded to. So we're not asking for anything automatic. We're not asking for guarantees. We're asking for a day in court and a chance to be heard. DPH needs that authority. There's a lot of things going on and changing. EMS is dynamic in Connecticut, and right now they don't have the authority or the teeth to get into any of the issues and address them when they're small. And unfortunately, what happens is the way the statutes are written, small issues need to grow into big critical emergencies before DPH can get involved, and that doesn't do good for any of us. So we're asking for DPH to have more authority to get involved at the ground level and to stop problems while they're small before they become big. And that's a benefit for all of us. The PSH task force truly saved the best for last, and recommendations number 1 through 4 are all going to improve EMS delivery in Connecticut. But number 5 speaks to those very issues that drove hundreds of your fire, police, and EMS people in uniform to the Capitol to call their legislators to give testimony. It's a highly motivated group of people that's doing this job every day, and they're the ones that are looking for the change, and they're the ones that are doing the service on the ground floor. The task force was given 5 charges by the legislature when we were put together. 2 of those charges spoke directly to the PSA system and making the reform. And those 2 charges are both answered in number 5. So effectively, almost half of the very reason for seating the task force is result in the number 5. And I just want you to understand that that was, you know, the issue that brought this forward, and that was really the issue that was most important to us, and it all rests in number 5. And I want to leave you today with the thought that number 5 is critical for municipalities. Please don't be surprised that number 5 didn't win unanimous endorsement. The report is unanimously endorsed. 14 of our task force members voted in favor of the final report. Number 5 had a simple majority of those at the meeting. But the existing statutes and regulations do not include specific performance measures for EMS. There's no established response times. It's not anywhere in the statutes. You're not going to find a requirement to be there in X amount of minutes. The provider simply has to show up to meet the minimum requirements. And the important takeaway for you here is that the municipality is directly responsible to the citizens to provide the highest quality of care. The municipality is the first person that gets the call, and we're the last ones off the scene. We deal with the needs of our citizens before, during, and after emergencies, routine and not. And the buck starts and stops at the municipality. We're the first one on scene and the last one off. And I just need you to keep that in mind, because at the end of the day, services can come and go from the community. I'm the one that's still there after they leave, and I'm the one that's answering the complaints and the calls, and I'm the one holding hands, and I'm the one picking up the pieces. And I need a role in having more of a say in how my system is delivered. So just for a minute, imagine that you had been doing the same job for 40 years. And in order to keep your job, all you had to do was to show up for work. And I'm not even saying you had to show up at a certain time. I'm just saying you had to show up, because that's very much the way our current system is set up. So now imagine that after 40 years of doing this job, I'm going to ask you to take a vote on whether you'd like to start having a performance evaluation that's going to be tied to the future of your employment. That performance evaluation is the equivalent of what you see in recommendation number 5. Suddenly, your performance, your competitiveness, your service delivery are all going to be compared to other providers, adding a new layer of transparency and quality control. Effective and efficient systems have adequate and appropriate checks and balances in place. We need financial incentives to assure competitiveness and consistency. So, how would you vote if you had been doing this for 40 years and none of this was tied to it, and suddenly you had to vote on whether you wanted to have these performance measures and this level of transparency and this competitiveness? It shouldn't surprise you that recommendation number 5 doesn't have a unanimous endorsement. It does have a majority endorsement. But I would ask you, actually, to realize that the fact that 5 was not unanimously endorsed should be the very reason that you need to bring number 5 forward, and you need to make sure that it happens, because it's that important. This is very relevant to the Moore Commission. The fact that we can change the way service is delivered, make it more efficient, more regional, whatever it is to meet the needs of our community and best suit the needs of our residents, speaks to the very heart of the mission of the Moore Commission. And that's why I'm asking for you to give it the thought that it needs. And in conclusion, I just want to leave you with the thought that primary service area responders, as they stand now, have enjoyed almost 40 years of having the right to be the exclusive provider of EMS in a designated geographic area in the state of Connecticut. Exclusive. One. Not competitive, just exclusive. The current CSA system allows them to continue to profit from this privilege indefinitely, provided they meet only the minimum requirements. It's not unexpected that these primary service area providers would support the status quo as it relates to PSA systems, so that they can indefinitely reap the benefits of this designation without concern for having to improve their service delivery or to react otherwise to the dynamic needs of the communities that need to be served. This current PSA system is essentially a monopoly, and monopolies are not good government.
Thank you. I'm not sure that the expectation was that they just show up for 40 years. I think there was always an expectation that they do their job well when they get there.
Absolutely, but the regulations don't speak to that. And that's, you're right, that's a
the
a
regulations
local level.
do speak to that, because the other side of it is no one has ever brought forward any complaints to the department about someone in the past.
That's not exactly true, and I spoke to that the last time I testified. I personally went and sat with the Department of Public Health with complaints, and what they're telling you is there were no formal complaints that were filed, and the reason for that was, and I'll tell you from my personal experience, and I know my colleagues testified that they've had similar experiences last time. When I go to the Department of Public Health and I say, I need to understand your process, this is my specific situation, tell me what I need to do to go through the process, and I'm told by the person that regulates that process, you know, you're looking to improve the service in your community, but the provider you have is meeting minimum requirements. That doesn't qualify to have them changed out. Don't bother filling out an application. Why am I going to go through the process and do that when I'm being told by the governing regulation authority of that agency not to do that? And I'm not the only one that was deterred from making that application.
Because if they truly weren't doing the job, I don't care what the Department of Public Health would say. I would feel that I, as someone from my town, have a responsibility to go forward with that complaint.
But that is the baseline, is they're doing the job. What about those of us that want to improve the service in our community? I can't make a change because that minimum requirement is being met, and I don't think we should stop there. I think we owe it to our citizens to take it a step further. If I can do something better, I should have the obligation and the right to look into that. We do it with every other service we deliver. I don't know why we'd want EMS to be the exception to that.
And I have a concern why 7 people of that group voted against number 5. So obviously there was a lot of contention when you have a vote that's that close. So I think that's part of the concern that this committee has, that there has to be some issues there. And obviously we're not seeing that in the report that made that one so contentious that it barely passed.
If you look, actually, both sides were able to give a position statement, and they both outlined their reasons for and against it right before number 5. And it was split, you know, basically among organizations. Clearly, the municipalities and many of the providers that are doing EMS felt that we need to have more of a say. And the people that have those PSAs that don't want to be subjected to that transparency and competitiveness are obviously fighting to maintain what they've had for 40 years. So, you know, that was the issue that came forward. It's always been a big issue, and it's going to continue to be a big issue. And I don't know that we're ever going to have consensus on that.
And the other thing is, do you think items number 1 through 4 do allow municipalities a pathway to make changes?
No, not enough.
So you think we shouldn't vote for them at all, that they don't matter?
4 are good. 1 through 4 are a home run. Absolutely, they're a home run. They're going to improve the system as it speaks, but they're not going to address the big problem. To ignore number 5 would be to say, you know, we did a little bit, but we didn't bother fixing the problem. It's almost like putting a Band-Aid on a wound and letting it to keep bleeding. It's not going to fix the big problem. And the big problem is that, you know, in communities, PSAs were granted 40 years ago, 20 years ago, depending upon when they were given out, and that's a lifetime appointment, and there's no ability to make change. Now, some communities have protected their PSAs and not allowed them to be given to anybody. Those municipalities have the right now to pick whoever they want to come in and do that service. You know, we talk about communities that are being offset by other communities in the provision of care, which is certainly a valid concern, but don't believe for a minute that 20 years ago or 40 years ago anybody made a master plan and said, here's the state of Connecticut, here's how we're going to match all this together. PSAs are granted based on either somebody got it themselves or somebody bought it and sold it, and that had nothing to do with a master plan anywhere. So there's not any rhyme or reason to it other than a company bought out another company and bought out another company and is now using that to balance their internal spreadsheets. It's not anything about the good of the state of Connecticut. It's about the people that hold those PSAs.
Does Farmington have a master emergency plan for the town of Farmington?
Yes.
Okay. Questions? Representative Zebron?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a moment to really thank you for all the passion and work that you've done. She happens to be a constituent of mine as well, and I've gotten to kind of watch over the last year how much time, energy, and passion you've put into this process. And I think you've really done a lot to start the conversation, regardless of which one we vote on now. I just want you to know that you've gotten a lot of people to think about how it affects their communities, and I'm so appreciative of the work that you've done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is David?
Yes.
David Lowell, who's the Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer of Hunter Ambulance, is the final speaker. Welcome. I understand you almost didn't make it here. You're caught up in traffic. Representative Fox is caught up in that traffic now, too. He just sent a message that he's en route but stuck.
Yeah, DOT issues on 91 North, for sure. So thank you for having me. This is my second time before before the commission. Representative Sayers and distinguished members of the committee. My name is David Lowell, and I appreciate this opportunity to come back and speak to the work. Before I get into my role in the legislative task force, you know, I come from a background of volunteer EMS, volunteer fire, an instructor for the state for a lot of years, commercial ambulance experience, and so have been around in a variety of communities, working within and among the system. And although my role was for the Association of Connecticut Ambulance Providers there, I think my perspective was maintained about the whole integrity of the statewide system. Right? We have 311 PSA responders out there that are either transport BLS or paramedic level. So the few that are referred to here that are profiting in using those kind of action words in statements really is distasteful, because that's not what this is about. This is about patient care at a community level. It's about a history of a system 40 years old that has, if you look at our statutes and you follow the history and the statutes, there are a tremendous amount of historical citations in the EMS statutes that they haven't been ignored for 40 years, that they have grown and evolved as things have occurred. I think I can say unanimously that everybody entered that room with similar goals. I do think that that's true. Patient care. We did also enter that room with some very overt agendas. Some people did. And so I think it's from that perspective, as I speak today and offer my legislation, that we provide a lot of caution, and I'm your poster child for the opposition on number 5, and I'll try to explain to the best of my ability why, based on those experiences. We certainly had a lot of constructive discussion, everybody on that committee, based on their years of experience and the circles that they traveled and performed in, no question. And certainly you've heard from our director and from the co-chair, Mary Ellen, that we also had spirited debate, which was very, very good. I will tell you, though, that none of us entered that room and none of us existed on that committee to say that the status quo was okay, because it was not okay. And that the issues that we heard in front of the legislature last year from some of the communities that are very important issues, that I don't think there was one task force member that agreed with how those issues were handled, weren't handled, weren't addressed using the current statutes and regulations. None of us were comfortable with that. That was a problem. I think if we had to vote on that, we would have voted that was unanimously a concern. Our association is absolutely in support fully of numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I want to explain why for a moment. I know, and I'll get to number 5 for sure, and I know you'll get to number 5 with me. But a lot of what we heard had to do about the quality of oversight. A lot of what we heard, and we just heard as a matter of fact, that services, and I'll paraphrase now, exist for 40 years and there aren't, with either little or no accountability or little or no attention to the details. In 2000, the legislature at that time passed Public Act 00151. 00151 addressed two very much quality issues that are at the core of the discussions that we had in the task force. And I would tell you that if you read them and see them, they're at the core of many of the problems that we heard discussed and talked about in individual communities. And what the two critical things were in Public Act 00151, it spoke to the removal of a PSAR. And although vague, and I think we all agreed that it was vague, and that's why we took the action that we did in one of our recommendations, the removal of a PSAR was put into two buckets, basically. Unsatisfactory performance, with no definition beyond that, and an emergency situation. So what we did in this document is we sought to define those, and we did it for two reasons: to give you municipalities the opportunity to have a list, and the municipal representatives were there, were comfortable with the list that, yeah, these make sense, these are the things we're looking for. We had service providers there that said, yeah, if we're providing service and we don't do those things, we ought to be held accountable. And if that has been the root of the problem, then it needs to be fixed. And the DPH representative that was there said, you know, I don't have enough tools in my toolbox on this because I don't know what unsatisfactory performance is. I could come up with my list, but I don't know if it's the same list that others would come up with. And so we sought to define that, and that was one of our best works here that we unanimously agreed to. And I don't want to get lost in number five and miss the opportunity to look at the tools that we did put in this toolbox that answer the direct questions that came up in front of us last year at the legislature and that we discussed. And so that's critical. So the other thing that Public Act 00151 did was direct public health at the time to implement with date-oriented delivery dates some very important things, the most important of which is a local EMS plan template, which it's my understanding that that was done and that there was a process put in place where that was distributed. And then I think the project, and again, this is no deference to the current administration because they weren't around at this time, the project fell by the wayside for whatever reasons. And so what DPH has told us in our pursuit of knowledge is that they don't have accurate records, and I think even Mr. Bereshansky testified to that today, that they don't have accurate records, they weren't maintained, they were outdated if they were ever done. And so we took on in our, it's Appendix E in your document, page 29, we took on the initiative to say, well, that's just not right. If the towns that came to the table are complaining that they are having quality issues with their provider, whatever model their provider is, what are the rules? Well, if the rules weren't followed through with back in 2000 when the legislation was put into place, and we don't have a record of the rules, then how can we hold them accountable? So we addressed the removal issue by providing definition for emergency and unsatisfactory. And then we sought to be prospectively active here and develop the local EMS plan. And we didn't just adopt what once existed because we didn't agree with the status quo. What we agreed to do is look at response times, look at percentages of calls that should be made by a provider in a community, by the primary provider, because there may be communities where a primary provider that currently has an assignment that might raise cause to an issue in that municipality might be only making 50% of their calls, and then somebody else is coming in doing that. And I think we all agree that that may not be the best thing in our state as a system-wide approach. And so what you'll see in that document, if you haven't looked through it, is you're going to see a lot of identification of who the players are, what are the standards of the players, and we left response times, I know that was referred to today, open, and we left them open for a number of reasons. What we had heard is municipalities want to control. Well, of course, it shouldn't necessarily be prescribed that an 8-minute, 90 minutes, or 8 minutes, 90% or better for all calls will fit all communities. That's a methodology for measuring response times. That we ought to have the local stakeholders sit around the table and engage in that discussion and say what makes sense for our community, given our demographics, given how we have to traverse our community, given how many resources we have available at one time, and have the discussion and put it on paper. So it empowers the municipalities. It allows for this to be used as a worksheet to set some quality standards that then provide a baseline for non-performance that get us back to the other piece of legislation, which we know from testimony hasn't been used, that gives the service, you know, the standards that they have to meet. And if they don't need them, there's no secret. You know, something needs to be done. Corrective action needs to be done, or we're removing you. And there's a process for that. So these were two very, very important pieces that answered a lot of questions. And I would say to you that number four, which I believe I'll get to it here in a second, that number four, at least from my perspective, by defining how a provider could be removed, was the pivotal solution to creating a number five. Right? So we define the rules. All the players around the table should agree to the rules. And by the way, in the language that we adopted in number one through four, if the players don't agree, if the PSA provider says at the table, I can't do that. I can't pull it off. I can't move to that level of service. I can't provide that level of response time. Well, then guess what? It falls into the cause bucket for the municipality to move forward. So all of those things connected very, very well. All of those things were great expansions, were certainly far from agreeing with status quo. In summary of this section of what I'd like to offer for remarks, you know, page 12 and 13 define the standards for the emergency removal and what unsatisfactory performance is. First time ever that those have been, you know, presented in black and white text in a body of work like this that we're actually promoting goes through a legislative process. 80% of the first call responses in a rolling 12-month period. There is a benchmark. You don't meet it, you're not performing, there's cause. So we support all of that. Number five, unless there's questions on, well, if there's questions at this point, but number five. So in the discussions, the spirited debate, the negotiations to get to this, knowing that an agenda that came in the room was to wholesale give back all PSAs, that this was alleged to be a compromise, we crafted number four to provide the tools. We crafted the EMS plan to provide the rules and bring the players together. So municipality provider is talking. And by the way, if they weren't talking, well, there's avenues in that language to get DPH involved to try to mitigate those disagreements or if there's a stalemate of any kind. And so it was our belief that those provided necessary enhancements to the system that hadn't previously been existed and renewed those statutes that had never been followed through with. So then we come to number five. And number five, at its surface, has very good things on the piece of paper. I would tell you that. By themselves standing alone, none of us are going to disagree with improved patient care. So when I don't vote for number five, I'm not saying I like bad patient care, as some would have you believe. Efficiency in delivery systems, we support that. Allocation of resources, our EMS system across the state depends on that. Regionalization. Right now in our state, because it has existed for a lot of years and evolved, because there have been administrative processes prescribed by statute and regulation of certificate of needs, where an administrating hearing officer presides over a process where the public is allowed to testify and bring in, where the impact on services and communities is evaluated. Systems have been designed, not restricted to individual municipal boundaries, but that provide regionalized approaches through a conglomerate of volunteer providers that provide their mutual aid resources among and between their boundaries and even across the EMS regional boundaries. The commercial providers that have multiple PSAs have resources that move by and between, not stripping one community from a resource and giving it to another, but the quantity of resources allows movement through the system to expand and contract to call volume. And so we have a lot of infrastructure of regionalization that exists today. Has it been formally evaluated? I'd probably say no. Should it be? I'd probably say yes. But what I am fearful of, passing number five will surely create an environment that we bypass that, go to a individual municipal silo-based environment that could happen. That scares me. We haven't created a safety net willy-nilly across the state. It's been through hearings and assessments and needs evaluations. We know there are providers that probably aren't playing by the rules, and we had sufficient discussions about that. And we've taken steps to put things in that help DPH administer over that and also educate the municipality and the provider what the rights and wrongs are. The fundamental thing that we didn't agree with number five as it stands, given all of that other background that actually supports the quality of the system, is the fact that without cause, a provider could be removed. And although it would say here that DPH is going to consider these, it's not an all-inclusive list. That's a bit subjective. The determinant factors are some that we would certainly support. We wouldn't want DPH to make a decision that is adverse to patient care. But if it's same-same, and some of what we heard, control for the sake of control, I would ask at what cost and at what risk to the system integrity of the providers that are doing a good job, where there isn't going to be an enhancement. And that's where our impasse came, that we were simply looking for the at cause. We thought we had solved it in number four. It was not satisfactory to those that voted in favor of number five. They still wanted the ability to really indiscriminately take that. Now, I heard Mr. Barashansky's testimony today, and it was good to hear, Ray, because what we also lacked, I think the other thing that happened here is this process, we were coming down to the 11th hour. And so we needed to get the product done. And so spent a lot of hours crammed in the 11th hour to be driven to get to something that we could agree on. And I think sincerely everybody tried so that we could have unanimous consensus on the entire document. But at the end of the day, we were out of time to drive this any further. I think there's some things lacking here about what the DPH process would look like. And perhaps, there would be language there that would be acceptable to the PSARs. There's, many of the PSARs, if not most, have investments in their members, investments in their employees, investments in their physical facilities, investments in their vehicles, equipment, the training. There needs to be some thought to what that all means. If it's a complete takeover and give back, that would create a whole host of problems for agencies, volunteer, municipal-based, commercial-based. And it doesn't speak to that here. So there's concerns without the cause, and that's where we fundamentally fell short. In terms of the vote, because that's been brought up a number of times, two of the dissenting votes were actually stakeholders in our public health community that have no dog in the fight, per se. It's a public health official, I think, from the town of Greenwich, and an attorney and a public health person with Connecticut Hospital Association. And they were on the dissenting side. They did not agree with five, and I believe they agreed because without cause, it would create a whole host of risks, unintended risks, that would cause potentially greater harm. So I guess I summarized. I didn't really read my testimony, but you have it for future reading if you would so like. I've tried to summarize the best I can where the group that sat where I sat on the issue of number five was. And I'd be happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
I do have a couple of questions, and one of them I asked Ray, so I'll get that out of the way early on. And Mr. McPherson talked about consideration of adding another paramedic mm-hmm. to their service. And my question is that something that could, in a helpful way, we could make it more of a regional entity? Because more and more communities are coming up with that very, very question. Do they have adequate paramedic service, or do they even have paramedic services, and how do they provide that? And because that has the biggest cost in terms of emergency medical services, are there better ways to do that that are less costly to the municipality?
I would say to you, any system design that looks at those kinds of resources would be yes, and it's probably true that some of the regionalization we do does prove out that way. Another example, on our EMS advisory board, there's been a paramedic subcommittee, and years ago, and I can't tell you how many, one of their objectives was get a paramedic to every patient in the state within 15 minutes. And in that discussion and in those subcommittees of our EMS advisory board, you know, that was the discussion. Okay, how are we going to do it? It's not going to be every town having one on every corner, because you just, it's cost prohibitive based on how many times you do advanced life support when you get activated as 911 and how many times you don't, and it becomes a basic life support. And so it's absolutely a valid question. Thank you for the question. I think that it should be looked at. I know in Middlesex County, Middlesex Hospital is a regional paramedic provider and they're mostly all 16 or 17 volunteer towns.
And why that's a big concern for me, I know up my way, most of our services are all volunteer services. But what has happened, they've had to add paid paramedic services to that. So it sort of changes the makeup of those ambulance services. And I would have to say I have one problem with the previous speaker in that they didn't just show up. Most of them have their heart and soul in providing those EMS services to the town, and they work very hard at it. But I think to Mr. Chris's comment is that it's getting harder and harder to find people that have the time to give up the number of hours that it requires to do that on a voluntary basis. So what we're finding, either they're going to a paid services, and which is additional cost, and they no longer really are a true volunteer ambulance services, or how do they just manage that? And to me, that's the bigger concern, because that's what I see happening in so many of our towns, because most of the outlying towns are more likely to have a volunteer service than a paid ambulance service, although it's just moving that way just to keep people, because they don't have the volunteers. Or, you know, I mean, companies in our town, big companies used to allow EMS, volunteer firemen, and all those time off from work. They could leave. When the whistle went off because there was a fire in town, people could leave their job and go out and be part of that firefighting team or be the EMS. That doesn't happen anymore. So things are really changing, and I think that we're going to see, not only we're going to see the problems that we've seen now, but we're going to see more and more problems, because that's the changes that are truly happening.
You're absolutely correct. And there is critical differences across all corners of our state of how EMS is delivered. I'll just pick on basic life support for the moment. There are some that still respond from a location and go to a location to pick up a vehicle and go to a call. And there's a response time associated with that process. And there are some volunteer services who actually staff at a location where their ambulance is, staff the ambulance. And so there's a response time model for that, both volunteer services. One of the critical realities across our state everywhere is to deliver EMS in a community costs money. There's no question about it. One of the good things, and let me just add, I don't know if I effectively communicated this, we are no less of a monopoly, EMS, than fire police services, who have the exclusive right and responsibility to do and respond. One of the things that EMS does have is it's healthcare through and through, from the start of the day to the end of the day. And therefore, it attracts reimbursements from the healthcare industry, right? And so there are different reimbursement demographics in every community. Some communities are more affluent, have private insurance, very well funded, the reimbursables to the services, 99% of which in the state, regardless of their construct model of their service, bill for services. High payer mix, commercial insurance. There are some that have a Medicaid population in the 30 to 40% of their payer mix, which pays $200 on an estimated $400 cost to provide that ambulance transport, which is a study that came out of Washington as they looked at urban, suburban, rural across the country and including Connecticut, what the average cost of an ambulance was in the emergency setting. So in that community with the 30% Medicaid rate and probably another 40 to 50% Medicare rate, both which under reimbursed compared to the cost of that service to provide it, the dollars have to come from somewhere. If you want to have that paramedic life pack on there, if you want to have the staff paid, if you want to have the benefits, if you're going to support your workers' comp, if you're going to have the ambulance that rolls and doesn't break down, those are the realities that every community does have to address, but it's an individual community discussion because of the different demographics of the people that live there and their health care coverage.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Zebron.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony. You know, what I find sometimes is uncomfortable conversations are productive, and this sounds like it was a pretty uncomfortable conversation, but it was one that I think really needed to be had. So I appreciate your involvement and bringing that to the table. As a representative of Middlesex County, I certainly know full well that most of our services are volunteers. And because of Mary Ellen's really push for conversation, I was able to send her comments to my ambulance associations to get feedback. Again, it's important to have those conversations and look in the mirror sometimes. And so I really do appreciate the efforts on both sides of the argument. I'm curious, recently Middlesex Hospital in the last few months has begun looking at developing their own ambulance service to provide transportation for folks, I believe, in convalescent homes, maybe if they're being discharged from the emergency room, and in non-emergency sort of ways. I'm curious, has your organization been supportive of those efforts?
We have not been. We are supportive of patient care movement in and out of their facilities. You know, they certainly have an application on file. I can't really speak to some of the discussions that have happened between the parties. I don't think it would be appropriate. The state is reviewing their application, and we've provided, honest testimony. But again, I would get back to that the way the system has been designed through the years. Certificates of need for providers across the spectrum have been based on an analysis of what's the volume, what do we need for resources to meet that volume. In the commercial end of things, that's twofold. It's emergency call volumes if you have PSAs, and it's non-emergency call volume that requires stretcher movement ambulances. And so those have all been administered through a hearing officer process to evaluate those things, and decisions have been made on resources based on those volumes, based on impacts. In our simple view here, I'll share with you that our argument is the volume is being met, maybe not in a timely manner, that they want with a new initiative of a forward movement of patients, that they may or may not communicate with their provider, which doesn't help their provider meet the demand. The transports are being done. So the displacement would be of a provider that has been approved resources to do those. So that would be my short version. I'd be happy to talk with you offline if there's additional. But I wanted to give you as complete an answer out of respect for you as I could today sitting here.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions from members of the committee? Yes, Ms. Glassman.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I just have a quick question. So on page 15 of the task force's report, the opponents, including yourself, had indicated that if a municipality can select their own provider, that there may be some unintended consequences. Particularly, I wanted to call out into question number 3 and number 4 listed there, the more affluent communities can demand and afford to pay for better levels of EMS care. You had touched upon this during your testimony, but if you could give a little bit more explanation behind why a municipality's ability to choose their own provider may negatively impact some of the more economically disadvantaged communities.
It gets back to the quantity of resources that exist today in the communities, right? So they have been, based on historical call volumes, and the system has grown based on that. When you have a community that funds in part, has the ability to fund because of the demographic mix of the payers for the patients that are transported, they're going to put more resources into that system or be able to assist those resources. Disadvantaged communities might have to put more. If a 30 to 40% community with 30 to 40% of Medicaid might have to dump 2 or 3 times as much resources into their system to support, because the demand, the call volume doesn't necessarily change, but the reimbursement for the calls that you do and the reimbursement for your state of readiness to respond for the call volume is going to be the same. We're like hospitals. We accept everybody on a 911 call without regard to their ability to pay. We have no uncompensated care fund and no way to access underinsured or uninsured transports in a community. So if the affluent community has good payer sources, they may not have to fund very much at all, if any. And it could be done on the receivables of whatever type of service type is doing the work within that community. But if you strip resources and we go to individual communities, if 169 towns had 169 ambulances that would not flow as freely across borders to do the mutual aid work in a regionalized approach, I would suggest that it's not going to be as fiscally responsible and get to the mission of what I understand the Moore Commission to be, to get to the efficiency levels.
Thank you.
Mr. Paul?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to follow up with what Kimberly's talking about. The one that bothers me most by the opponents is number 1, where it says PSARs will be unwilling to invest the capital necessary to most effectively operate the PSA if they can be removed at any time. Please explain that to me, because sure, I have a hard time believing that an organization that is designed and its model is to provide medical aid to someone of need would even make that as an issue with opposition to the proposal number 5.
Very good question. Thank you. Because we did talk about that, I think, quite a bit in the task force and in other circles. You know, and I think that gets to the point of if there is no security of having the responsibility for a period of time, whatever time that is. Currently, it's in perpetuity, and that's what's been debated, whether it should be. And a service invests in their vehicles and the medical equipment and physical facilities and could lose that assignment in a year or two when they haven't fully depreciated, haven't fully paid for it, haven't, you know, that becomes a real upside down situation for the facility. So it's not a willingness to provide good equipment and good, it's if you make this temporary, how are we going to balance our decisions to make these long-term investments to increase quality of care, to buy those, life packs, to buy the vehicles and invest in them? That's really what it gets to. So it's not intended to be threatening, and if that's the way it comes across, it's not. it gets to the sense of this temporary nature that, you know, decisions, and I can't speak for every PSAR, but I can tell you that that's a decision. You know, what's the longevity of this piece of equipment if we're spending $20,000 on a life pack, if we're spending $8,000 or $10,000 on a stretcher, if we're spending $70,000 or $150,000 on an ambulance? You know, we better have 5-10 years to depreciate those to at least recoup, and that's any service model out there. Commercials, the volunteer, whoever, those, that equipment's necessary. So we see that the stability in the PSA for periods of time is essential for that.
Thank you. But I get the sense, and maybe I'm misunderstanding. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. But I get the sense, and based on, and I apologize if I mispronounce your name, but the based on the testimony of Mr. Bereshansky,
perfect.
I get the sense that this is not going to be quick turnovers, that there's going to be a process in place that could take a year, 2 years, or I can't imagine it's only going to take 3 or 4 months. But there is a process in place, or would be in place. So I don't believe, as you've indicated, that there would be 169 towns with 169 different PSAs. I've got to believe that, as I said earlier, that there's probably going to be a spatterings of things, and it still just troubles me that that statement or that justification. I understand the business model. I understand I have four fire companies in the town of Litchfield, and we support every one of them, and I have one volunteer ambulance, and we support every one of them with the purchase of their ambulances and the purchase of their fire companies, I mean their fire trucks. So I understand, you know, the model of you know, getting back your investment on the item you're buying. So I fully understand that, but it just bothers me that that's the number one issue that is on the opponent's list. So I'm not trying to be argumentative.
It's
just my comment, sir.
And you raise a perfectly good point. I think and this just gets to the heart. I appreciated everything Director Bereshansky said, and I reflected on that because it's we've had a lot of discussions, and you know, most of them all very, very good. But he went into a little bit more depth about his position from the office today that I've had the opportunity to hear. And, you know, what we lack with recommendation number 5 is all the nuts and bolts that if it were to be carried out in any format, you know, what would it look like? There's a lot of details missing there that give some sense of stability to the system that exists today, to the providers that are playing by the rules. And, I think, again, I'll just get back to that's our biggest concern is the way that the recommendation is written without substantive backup within the Department of Public Health, knowing that there is somewhat of a competing process now with the ability of a municipality to petition that we're actually promoting universally to strengthen and provide a lot more rules that I think everybody thinks are great. So that thing is already structured in statute. There's a process. It's an administrative process. There's timelines. This is not structured. It leaves it wide open. And as much as I like and respect Ray and Wendy, I recognize that they may not always be in the position that they're in now, and that what we're looking for is the nuts and bolts language that would give a sense of stability to the PSARs that are playing by the rules, that are doing a good job. Yeah. And we don't see that in number 5. We see a concept, but again, partly due to, I think, our need to get the document out to meet timelines. And we debated this quite a lot.
Thank you. I just have two other comments, Madam Chair, if that's okay. First, I understand what you're saying, but I believe that there is a process, and those PSAPs that are performing, I don't think have anything at all to be concerned about. That's what I've heard, and that's what I heard in our previous testimonies a couple of weeks ago. So I think that the item 5 at least provides an opportunity for refinement, and I think it's worth voting for, because it provides opportunities or it provides an opportunity for a PSEP that's not performing to have to go through a review process. And through that review process, if I understand what has been testified to here, if they go through that review process and they can answer the questions that the community may have objection to, then I think that they're protected or they'll be safe. So that's the only comment I have to say, except one more thing, and I want to come to the defense of Mary Ellen. Madam Chair, with all due respect, I don't think by her comment people just showing up to work was a dig at the people who were actually working. I think her comment was more in line of if someone has security of job, they're going to that's all I believe her comment was in reference to. I don't think it was people are just showing up and not committed to what they're doing. So I just wanted to give my piece on that, Madam Chair. All due respect intended.
I did ask her about it.
Okay. Through the chair, may I respond to something you said? Because is it sure?
Yes, sir.
So I applaud your optimism. I'm on board with your optimism. That if and to paraphrase what I heard, and if I didn't hear it correctly, please correct me. But if somebody's playing by the rules and there's a review process, they should feel secure. If that's the case, I'm on board with them. Five doesn't do that yet, and that's why there's caution, abundance of caution. What does do that, and where we did have sufficient dialogue, because our task force actually started looking at draft regulations. Now, I commented earlier that the statutes have received a certain amount of housekeeping, and they certainly have, and you can see that in the public act history that goes to each of the statutory line items. What has received a lot of work but hasn't made it to the light of day for practice is our regulations, and I think that's true across the spectrum. And one of the things that got discussed in the regulations is a five-year review, which we are absolutely supportive of. So long as it wasn't a review and revocation, if you play by the rules, there ought to be a reasonable likelihood, if you're doing a good job, that you can keep doing it. But you've got to be at the table. You've got to agree to performance standards. You've got to be able to put it up there. And so the draft regulations, aside from this, have got to be moved forward. And I know, again, that's true in a lot of departments in our government right now, but that speaks to the five-year review that OEMS wants to, that I think has universal consent from the stakeholders that have helped craft it. It also further, I think, delineates the performance standards that would guide DPH, that would guide communities and guide providers. And so the regulation, passage of regulations and moving that forward is going to be key. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other additional questions? Okay. Mr. Paul?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to reply. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I'm just going to say it. I'm not going to be willing to vote on something that's not going to include Section 5 or Recommendation 5 because all the other sections does not give, I don't, as far as I can see, but I'm just glancing at this through today, does not give the municipality the opportunity to participate in that except to complain about the services, and I find that troubling. You know, municipalities, I'm going to use number 6 on those that are opponents. You know, we go out to bid for proposals to determine the best way to provide the best service to our communities, and I think this is an opportunity for that, and I think the overriding issue here is to provide the best service we can to all the residents in the state of Connecticut, and I think that this competition and competition in this arena would certainly provide for that better service. That's just one final comment, sir. I'm not trying to be argumentative. I just wanted to put my piece out there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'm very concerned about how number 5 impacts on so many of our ambulance services that are volunteers.
Thank you, President Zee. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to dig into that a little deeper. So for communities who have volunteers, you know, one of the things I heard back from one of my towns was, you know, they were very concerned about some of the provisions because they already are having such a hard time retaining volunteers just simply because of the pace of life. So if when I'm reading Recommendation 5, maybe if you could tell me, tell me how number five is damaging to a community with volunteers, and take the commercial aspect out of it, if you would.
And I appreciate that, and I think although I've answered with some of what the commercial market does, I think most of my responses have been on behalf of any individual PSAR. Having the right to feel secure that if they're doing a good job and can play by the rules, that they're not at risk for losing it. And I feel strongly. And you're right. Some of our more remote areas that may not have resources, perhaps performing at a level that you or I might think is most appropriate and that other communities do, was shared somewhat in the task force, but it's also known. And I think I'll go back to the local EMS plan and the fact that we're requiring response time standards, which were not part of the previous plan, to be now included and defined, might create a little pucker factor in some of the communities that haven't either been at the table for lack of knowledge, haven't been at the table because of a refusal to sit at the table, aren't connected with their municipal providers because we've heard or their municipal representatives because we've heard stories of that, and that's just not right. So to sit down and craft this plan is going to be a reality check for the stakeholders in that community. Can we or can't we, first of all? And if we can't, what do we do? Because now you're dealing with a for-cause issue. You're not even on recommendation number five. Because the reality check is we can't do this or we can't advance to this level. So then the municipality, and that's what gets into the recommendations about the removal for cause. If they can't meet the requisite level of care, the municipality can then take an action to do something. And we feel that's appropriate all day long. But we also felt that, I'm sure others were like-minded with me across the spectrum, that imposing something new on the EMS community as a whole ought to provide for some recognition of ramp up of those services, right? So if they aren't doing it now, but now DPH unleashes this new EMS plan and a new requirement to have it completed by a community and have it to us by, and we'll provide technical assistance if you need it, there ought to be the opportunity for all of those stakeholders in that community, in that volunteer community, to see how they can achieve it, because that's what it's driven to do. Is we've heard modernize, but advance the system. You know, strive to, if you can be 80% 9 minutes or under, and the goal in 6 months is to be 90% of the time you're 8 minutes and under, that would be an awesome use of the local EMS plan tool. It would be an awesome intention of, I think, the entire collaboration of our PSA task force, and certainly within everybody's goal to see happen in those communities.
Pastor, did you have a question?
I just have one other comment to make. I'm sorry that your area you can't get the volunteers out at day, but I will tell you.
Oh, we do fine.
Okay, because
yeah,
because
but I know that it's an ongoing problem. It's just, as Mr. Chris said, it's becoming for many communities in terms of their firemen, and a lot of them do first responder services. So
right.
it is, and as we go forward, because more and more the work and the two parents working at things, we're going to have a harder time having this happen. So it's changes for the communities, and I don't want us to have a crisis and then have to react to a crisis. I like to plan ahead for these types of problems.
And that's what we struggle with the volunteers in our communities, trying to make sure that we have people who are willing to volunteer. But in Litchfield, and I'm certain Harwinton's the same way, and the entire northwest corner, or most of the northwest corner, we have people who work in the community, and when that alarm goes off, they're in the trucks or they're in the ambulances, and they just leave their offices or they leave their gas stations or wherever they're working. If they're mowing grass or shoveling walks, they leave and go take care of the folks. So we have it pretty lucky in the northwest corner, I guess.
Yeah, if I could just jump in there, Madam Chair, you do. Because in my community, sometimes it goes to a second call to mutual aid. And that's a scary place to be. So, and that's, a part of my concern. I I really am concerned about that, and what kind of message are we sending to the volunteers? You know, it's something I have to think about on behalf of the people I represent. And you know, in my within the three towns I represent, there's, you know, Colchester is a little different. East Hampton's still different, and East Adams still different. It's unfortunately, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Right, and I will tell you, in my own town, what's happening with the ambulance service there, it went from a purely volunteer ambulance. It's actually incorporated, and they have almost all paid staff now. So even though it is still not an ambulance company, they are incorporated, and they have paid staff. And that's how they manage it. But I just know going forward that this is more and more of a problem, and the need to add more and more paramedic service for most of the calls that go out there. Whether they have a rudder car that meets the ambulance somewhere along the way or however they manage it, is becoming more and more of a difficult thing. And I want to make sure that going forward that our towns have the resources. This is very important. Our population is aging. We have more and more need for increased ambulance services. And we have to be able to provide that if we're going to provide quality health care. And so I think that we can't ignore it. We have to really look at that.
If I may come in, because this was exactly the kind of dialogue we had in the PSA task force, and it's exactly the dialogue that was causation for recommendation number four and the EMS plan, and that it shouldn't be left to not be done again if legislation is passed. Those two key, recommendation four and the one of the EMS plan, deal a lot with those issues. It's the local assets, what can they do, what are they doing, what do they need to do? And then if they're not able to do it, what can we do about that? That definition wasn't there. It is now.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Okay. If I could just ask Ray one question. Sorry to do this to you. I'll
gladly relinquish my
chair the hot seat, huh?
To the esteemed director.
Mr. Lowell talked about regulations, and I just wanted to ask Ray if the department is planning on implementing draft regulations or are working on regulations, or what the status of regulations would be, because I think that would spell a lot of this out in more detail.
When the process, when the PSA task force initially met, I believe there was a question from somebody, I think it was Bob actually, when we began this, and it was September. We had just finished some of the internal trials and tribulations in regard to our revised regulations, which have not been revised in about a dozen years. Wendy, Furness, and myself made the determination after seeing how the task force was moving that what we were going to do is place a very temporary hold on our regulations owing to the fact that some of the task force language could very well wind up having to be implemented in regulation. So as it stands right now, internally, we are ready to move forward in regard to the regulations. We are, however, waiting to see what goes on with the processes of the PSA task force. That being said, there are elements of what the task force came up with, actually quite a few elements of what the task force came up with, that we will be moving forward with in regard to the regulations. As one of the specific ones was what Mr. Lowell just stated in regard to some of the definitions in point four that we look at and say that's a win-win for us. So as it stands right now, we're waiting to see what happens in regard to the PSA task force, but those regulations are ready to move forward. I believe that the next move is for them to go to our commissioner for review.
Okay, thank you. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I just it was mentioned and I just needed Representative Nicastro.
No problem.
Are you saying that the articles here will leave five out for the moment? Are you saying that we shouldn't vote on 1 through 4 today while this is all being reviewed?
No, Representative. I wouldn't say anything like that.
I'm asking, is that what you were implying? That's what I asked.
No, nor am I implying that.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. Any other questions? Excellent. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Bob.
Madam Chair, I have a question about our next steps, and if I could, I'd like to make a motion on recommending a vote on the EMSA task force, EMS task force recommendations as presented to this committee in their entirety, recommendations 1 through 5, with the understanding that there was a consensus on the report and that we moved to endorse what that task force deliberated over. What we heard was a great lengthy amount of time.
Madam Chair, I will second the motion.
Yes. It seems that there is some, there may be, I feel like instead that we should have a motion to vote on recommendations 1 through 4 separately, then we can take a vote on 5, because I think there may be some more disagreement over 5 amongst members of this committee.
Mr. Labanera, since you made the original, would you want to amend that or rescind that and then amend it? Because I think that that's a very important point. I wouldn't have, do 1 through 4 and then do 5 separately.
With all due respect, no. I think we have the report in front of us that was approved by the task force of the experts deliberated. And I would move again that we vote on items in the task force report. With all due respect, thank you.
Ben?
Well, as Kim said, I mean, if one opposes any of the individual items, that vote leaves no choice or leaves no option to express that opinion, which means you'll end up with a vote that doesn't accurately represent the views of the committee. And since we're ultimately an advisory group, it is in fact the view of the committee that is more important than the outcome. And I would note that I would assume for legislation, if it got to that level, it's going to be the same thing. And it's not all or nothing. You actually have an opportunity to vote on pieces.
If I can't comment, I don't see it as an all or nothing vote. I think we heard from both sides that number 5 is a concept. It doesn't do certain things yet, I think was a quote. And I believe strongly that this group, the EMS task force, did a good job in putting together what they had to do and reaching a consensus, albeit by one majority vote. And I urge this committee, again, to act on what they produced. It's a very simple vote.
I would say that if we separate them out, it doesn't matter. We still would be voting on all the pieces of it. It's not like we're not going to vote on any one part of it. But people have requested that we separate it out. It allows them to vote for the parts that they want. So I think that would be a much better way to go in terms of this committee.
I mean, I'll defer to the discretion of the chair. We can entertain my motion and certainly entertain a motion afterwards if that's the case.
We have someone that it opened up as part of the discussion that they want to amend the motion that you made to add that we separate out number 5.
I don't believe there was a second to Kimberly's motion.
I think parliamentary procedure would be that there's a motion, the second, and I'll motion to move the question, please.
Second.
Nay. I'd like to make a motion that we vote on item recommendations 1 through 4 of the task force first, and then we can vote on recommendation 5 separately.
moved and seconded. All those in favor of items 1 through 4? Opposed? All right, so the motion passes on number 1 through 4. And then, did you say 5 separately?
Yes, 5 separately.
All right, we've had so much discussion now, I'm trying to remember.
I'm sorry, was that a vote on 1 through 4?
Yes.
Or not, it wasn't on process, it was actual on the vote.
It was actually...
On the substance, not the procedure.
I believe so, yes.
Okay, that's fine. So then, right, so now is the question on 5, I guess.
Now the question is on item number 5. And any discussion on number 5 before we vote on that?
Can I have a second?
I'll second.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
I'll second Kimberly's motion.
Oh, okay. I think that you made it all as one motion to do 1 through 4 and then to vote on number 5, but that's fine. I'm just asking if before we vote on number 5 if there's any further discussion. And I know my feeling is that because the vote was so close and there are really issues there that it really does need further looking at. I think that number 1 through 4, those are items that need to have the opportunity to be implemented and we can see how they work before we actually move forward. Mr. Lebanera?
I'd just like to say that a vote for number 5 does not say you would not further look at number 5. And that on a Friday afternoon, after about an hour and a half of presentations, to separate it out after a group that has met since September that voted for it, albeit by a narrow majority, does not mean it will no longer be worked on and discussed. And I would think it would behoove this group to push this recommendation along as a group that's been charged with seeking efficiencies at the municipal level. And if a task force designed at looking at this specific issue has agreed on this recommendation, that we should push this along. Thank you.
I would agree with that, but my thing is that I do believe that it will increase costs to some municipalities, and that is my major concern with that. Representative Nacosta?
We all have individual feelings. I understand where you're coming from, Bob, but we had a vote here. We said to separate it. The vote passed. So we should be doing 1 to 4 and then 5 separately. That's the vote. That's how you do it in a democracy. Sometimes we don't like the decision that comes out. Sometimes we're on the winning end. Sometimes we're on the losing end. This time, this is how it went. The vote went down.
If I could comment, my comments were based on the recommendation right now. We're voting on number 5 separately. Right. I just wanted to, for the record, thank you.
So all those in favor of recommending to the Public Health Committee number 5, please indicate. I think raising your hand is easier for us. Opposed? Motion fails. Now we get into pest. Yes. And I'm going to ask Representative Nacosta if he would report on the working group on pest management.
I knew that was going to happen. That's why I said to the chair, let's wait till they go out the door. Okay, for the last few weeks, the Committee on Pest Control has been meeting. It's been really having some very serious discussions, some darn good discussions. You have a packet in front of you that Representative Miller provided for me. Please understand that the only reason that was provided to me was that I asked Representative Miller, who is so pro on protecting fields and, you know, schoolyards and things like that. I asked him his opinion, and he sent me those three different articles, a letter from him to myself, and then two different articles. That doesn't mean we accept that, or we're just going to place that on file. That's all that's for. We haven't come up with a decision yet. We felt that we need more time because we're looking at a very serious issue here. But Representative Miller presented that to the committee. We met this morning at 11 o'clock, right?
Yes, I was there for just a brief moment, but I'm a little confused, Representative Nicastro, because I thought we voted on those recommendations at our prior meeting.
You mean Representative Miller's?
Before, we voted on those recommendations, and then Representative Miller's letter came a week later.
Oh, correct. That's what I'm talking. Yes, we did. Yes. I was talking about his letter. Okay. Anyway, we had some recommendations that were presented. I don't have them in front of me, son of a gun.
Also, in the packet of things you received, I had an intern who wrote up from Richard Calarco of Hebron Parks and Rec Director, a summation of some of the information that he provided to us.
Correct. I mean, that was just handed out to us just a little while ago.
Yeah.
If I may, Representative Nicastro, the points from Richard Calecro from Hebron Park and Rec are in direct opposition of Representative Miller's information, and I just wanted to say that for the record.
It's very obvious. Representative Miller's report was a nice report, and he didn't have to do that for us. He did it out of his own accord. I asked him to give us what he felt about this, being the way he's, you know, a strong believer in protecting fields, and he sent it. But I explained to Representative Miller that it was not the consensus of this committee to vote on his report. It was for informational purposes only. So I made that very clear, and I thanked him for that because he took the time to do it. This report from Richard Calarso, the Hebron MP, he testified before us. If you remember, he talked in front of us for quite some time a couple of weeks ago. This just came in today. I haven't even read it yet. I just got it. So, for discussion, I'd like to know what you think.
I might make a comment. I was looking at Representative Miller's, the information that was presented, and there is an outline on cost, and I'm looking at the cost. And one application of fertilizer, the cost of the product is $699, and the labor cost to apply it is $115. However, the next month, the same fertilizer costs $0, and the cost to apply it costs $0. So I think, I'm not sure who made up this comparison chart, but it has, it's very hard to take it and say that it costs less to do a natural program after the first 2 years when some of the information is, there's a problem with some of the information because I don't think you get fertilizer for free and it still costs money to apply it. So I'm not sure what the problem is, because he's not here to answer that, but I'm not sure really what the problem was in terms of the why it says zero.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I had the opportunity to kind of review, so I sent our expert, which is Mr. Calarco, some questions on that report, and his responses are here, and his responses and his handout are directly related to the reports that Representative Miller presented, and you'll note under the first line where it says a cost of conventional turf management, natural turf management for school fields, he's referring to this report. And I think it should be noted that the authors of the report have a commercial business specifically for folks who adopt organic programs in the field. And I not to say that they don't have some good information here, but I think it's important to note that. And I think if you go through and look at these graphs, you'll know, a lot of unfortunate inconsistencies. It goes on to talk about, that it may be a little optimistic about the amount of seeding. Irrigation, for instance, isn't included in the capital cost, where irrigation would be really needed in fields, especially K through 8. And, you know, I don't know about your district, but in my district, we're not irrigating K through 8 fields. You know, we save those capital costs for high school fields. So anyway, so that's kind of what this is. And at the last, you'll see on the second page, it says guidance on Chapter 85 laws of 2010. And that is in response to the second handout from Representative Miller. And I do appreciate Representative Miller's efforts, and I'm very familiar with his district. And I know he has one school, I believe at least, that has really tried to leverage their knowledge of organic maintenance on their fields. But I have to tell you, I am getting calls all the time. The latest was from an old classmate. Oh, she's younger than me, who is now the sports medicine person at the high school. And, you know, we never had that in high school. We wrapped our own bandages. We never had somebody come up and do that for us, but that's not the way they do it now. And she just got done telling me about 3 injuries last week alone on the middle school field in my town because of the complete infestation of not just grubs but crabgrass. And I spoke at the last meeting about the unfunded mandate, and that's why it's before us. And so while I do appreciate Representative Miller's passion, I do think that there is a physical, not just a financial cost, but a physical cost to deteriorating fields, and that's hurting our kids too. And I'm glad to be able to have that discussion here.
Mr. McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I would like to apologize to you and Representative DeCastro and Representative Zilbrun and whoever else may have been there at 11 o'clock for some reason that did not make it onto my calendar. And so I apologize for not attending that meeting, although I was at the other.
I was absent also, sir. So.
Oops. I feel in good company then. Thank you.
The only people that were there was the attorney and myself.
But I was at the earlier meetings where we engaged in some lengthy conversations, and yes, I do recall that we passed as a subcommittee the items 1, 2, and 3 of this report, and I think that they represent a very reasonable approach. It does not swing the pendulum one way or another, but it strikes a good balance for the moment, because I think we're all concerned about the effects of grubs and crabgrass on the kids that have to play on these fields, plus the money to even get halfway to a decent field. Highly unlikely you're going to get as good a field. So I would support this mandate subcommittee, Madam Chair, of adopting these 3 provisions from the subcommittee. Thank you.
Mr. McPherson, I'm not seeing anything labeled 1, 2, and 3, but I think that we talked about using best management practice, utilizing that integrated pest management, and then the deep advisory committee, which existed at one point and ruled on all of these things but is no longer active, that they reactivated the advisory committee so that towns could go before them with problems that they had to get to be able to use alternative mechanisms for those types of problems that they're having. In other words, to use, for instance, one of the things that Mr. Clarego spoke about was what application of Roundup would do a better job than half a dozen applications of an organic type thing, and that none of the organic types of things took care of things such as poison ivy.
Madam Chair, pardon me, I am looking at the report from the subcommittee, which starts out a consensus of the members of the pest control group, et cetera. Oh, you don't have it. Okay.
But I think you should read it because we don't happen to have it in our files.
I'm sorry. I dug it out of my, and they are, that the pest control working group recommend that the municipal mandate subcommittee, that's us, add the following items to the 2014 list of recommendations to the Connecticut General Assembly. One, that the Pesticide Advisory Council, as constituted in Connecticut General Statutes 22A-65D, be utilized, A, to review all new pesticides on a rolling basis for safety and effectiveness, and B, to report its findings and recommend standards to the Commissioner of DEEP for consideration in making regulations. As an aside, that was intended to take these detailed regulations away from the laborious legislative calendar and put them into the expert, make it an expert regulation, which is where it belongs. Then number two, that DEEP, in consultation with the Pesticide Advisory Council, create, publish, and regularly update a set of best practices, including review of the Massachusetts IPM monitoring website for use by municipalities regarding the safe and effective use of both synthetic and organic pesticides. And three, that DEEP shall establish a regionalized purchasing mechanism for pest control products through which municipalities may obtain products for a reduced price. These were the three items that we adopted. There were several more that we did not pick up on that require further study, but I think the three items that we did recommend for inclusion are certainly not revolutionary in any sense. They're common sense amendments.
Thank you. And David tells me he believes that we already voted on those recommendations at our previous meeting. So I guess that we don't need to vote on them again at this time. So if there's any more discussion on that.
We have so much going down this past week, it's unbelievable. Anybody can remember anything. I'm telling you, it's the truth. I'm dead serious. Try going to five different meetings at the same time.
Public hearings I've had all day. The last item on here is notice requirements for the sale or transfer of municipal property. And this was in relation to Mr. Paul's concern with when it was municipal property and the posting and all.
Jesse had handed a proposed language, but it has not been.
It's sort of in draft form.
It's not in the final stage. As a matter of fact, before he left here, he had some words circled that I had asked him about.
Right. And I think some of it was to allow municipalities to put that information on a website in lieu of or post it in a free weekly newspaper.
Correct. That was language that was added. To my glee, I'll tell you, I'm very happy about that. It gives us the opportunity to further that discussion as we go forward. But the crux of the whole problem, if you can bear with me, and I'll repeat it again, is that the new law came out and it required us to post in the newspaper two postings to notice a public hearing at a Board of Selectmen's meeting. Board of Selectmen in the town of Litchfield, and I don't know of any other boards of selectmen that generally holds public hearings. That's usually done at our town meeting. And then the other piece of it was to make sure that there was a very conspicuous sign that was posted on the piece of property. And one of the things that you might find problems with in rural communities like Litchfield is we may have a piece of town property that we might be transferring to a private resident for an easement, or we might be or switching pieces of property, and that piece of property might be landlocked, and there's really no one going to be able to see a sign. So the point of putting that sign on a piece of property, I see, is moot in some cases. So my request was to eliminate that requirement. The point of this whole thing is that in a town meeting form of government with boards of selectmen, if we are going to donate, transfer, or lease a piece of property, it requires going through a town meeting. And in order for us to have, before we get to that town meeting, we've got to have a number of boards of selectmen's meetings, and they're all open to the public with opportunity for public comment. And it just seemed to be a little bit more requirements on boards of selectmen's town meeting forms of government than was necessary. So that's where we are. Jesse's working with the speaker, I guess, and you are, ma'am, so thank you very much. In trying to adjust some of the language in that bill to make adjustments to it.
Right, and I know last year we were very interested in the bill that was out there that talked about making changes in the publishing the notification in a newspaper. In I think the last legislation looked at just making it a very announcement that you look on the website for further information rather than all the information as part of a newspaper article. And that legislation never did go anywhere. So we looked at this as a small way to maybe initiate making those changes, which is why when Jesse did the draft, he was very interested in that we add the language about posting on the website that information, as well as maybe even publishing it in a free weekly as alternatives to the actual publishing.
I love that move, and I think many, many of my colleagues and many of the communities that are part of CCM and COST will certainly embrace that. It'll give us an opportunity to further prove the cost savings that would be garnered by communities who would be allowed to, you know, in the newspaper advertise that here's, you know, the full text of whatever it is you're looking that you need to see, whether it's the notice of a town meeting or whether it's a piece of property that's being sold. Full text is available at the town hall or on the website. So I really do appreciate that, ma'am. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'll actually entertain a motion that we, the committee, vote in support of that draft piece of legislation going forward. Well, we have a second on that? All in favor?
Aye.
Yeah. Opposed?
Oh, we already voted. I was going to make a comment.
I'm sorry.
No. Although I appreciate the language changes, I don't think we're at that because it's still the requirement for the sign is still probably the most expensive piece of this that is the mandate. And Jesse said that he was going to try to work to see if that can further be adjusted. That's why I don't know if we're going to vote to support adjusting the bill, I'm all for that. Yes, ma'am, because correct. Yeah, I really do. I appreciate this, that this is something that's moving forward, and just that alone makes me happy.
Thank you, Kimberly. I'm sorry, I didn't see.
It's okay. I'm sorry. I have a meeting in just a couple minutes that I have to run to right now, so I apologize that I have to leave. But if we're going to be taking a vote on language that we don't have, I would like to be recorded as an abstention for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative DeCastro.
I just want to say this before we end this meeting. You know, I've been in government 28 years, and I've sat on all sorts of committees, you name it, chair different committees, mayor and all this stuff. But I've truly enjoyed this committee because everybody on this committee is sincere in what they want to do to help. And whether I agree with you all the time or disagree with you, it doesn't matter because nobody here has been rude, disrespectful, or anything. We've all had the chance to say how we feel and get things done. And that's how you get positive things done. Positive discussion, and you go for something. I mean, Leo and I have been on committees for quite a while now, for years, and we've agreed sometimes and sometimes we haven't. The point is, we get things done that way. And I'm so proud of this committee, and I can't wait for it to come back together. The chair stated that this is going to be our last meeting, and I don't know when the next one will be. I hope I'm wrong for it, but needless to say, this is the kind of committee I like serving on because we get things done. And that's what our constituents want from us, be you an elected official or be you just someone who sits on the committee. And I'm so proud of this committee. I say that sincerely, Madam Chair. You've done an outstanding job. I really am proud of what you've done. Thank you.
One last thing. Mr. McPherson brought before, I think he dropped a copy of this to everybody, and there were a number of items on it. Some of them were just discussed but not resolved. Some of them from last committee. One of them I don't remember a vote except a not vote. And number A, 1A. Well, I think you proposed it as a vote, and then we said it couldn't vote on it. But irregardless, we're not going to do anything with it today, but I will definitely, as we go forward and reconstitute again, because the speaker has indicated that he will continue with the Moore commission, and we will continue to meet. Obviously, for this session, we're done because what you know is bills are moving now. Things are going to move very rapidly, and anything that we did going forward would not have time to be incorporated into any kind of legislation. So we will keep these, and they will be there as we go forward for future discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, I want to apologize to the Chair and the other committee members. I realize we all have busy schedules and appointments and things of that nature. I arrived late to the meeting today. I left Stanford at 10:45 this morning, arrived at the LOB at about 2:15. So it was my longest trip here yet. I hope it is the longest trip ever, but I apologize to each of you for arriving late. Again, thank you for all your efforts on behalf of this committee and the state of Connecticut. Thank you.
I can validate Representative Fox's problems on I-91. I also got stuck in the same thing.
Mr. Lowell also sent me a picture of himself being stuck on that 91 traffic. So I think in general, I want to thank everybody. This has been fun as well as enlightening, and I think that we're able to do a couple of things, not as much as we probably all would like to do, but the process here is sometimes slow and sometimes cumbersome, and it's much easier in a small town. We have a first selectman and maybe two selectmen, which is what I am used to. You have four. We only have two, so there's only three bodies voting and town meetings. Which is a whole very different process than getting through all of this. So thank you all. I really appreciated it. Representative Nicastro.
I just want you to understand something. We want to show that we've done something. That's one of the reasons I voted for these four items to go out, because if these four items make it to the floor and if these four items pass, no one can say that the Moore Committee didn't do something. They can have more on their agenda. That way we come back. I can recall the first time we did have just about nothing come out. Guess what? That was the end of the committee. That was the end of it. Here we've got four possible bills now moving forward. And, you know, if they kill them or if they slow them down, it's not because of us. And I'm going to make sure, and I know our speaker will, that the speaker, our chairperson knows, that the speaker will know what we've done here and to help push these along. Because that's what he's looking for. He wants to know. He brought this committee back. And he wants to know that if something's being done. Well, here's your chance to show him. Let's show him. We got these coming out now. Let's get something done with them. So it's so vitally important because then we can come back. If he sees it's just all talk and no action, why bother to have it? So I want to thank all of you, too. Thank you.
Mr. Paul?
I want to take the opportunity to stroke everybody also here. Seriously, I a sincere gratitude to you, Madam Chair.
Thank
and
you.
To you, Representative DeCastro. You guys have been here through this whole thing, and I was just telling Bob, you know, we've gotten some things done. So, you know, I feel like it's worth serving on this committee. And as you said, Representative DeCastro, we didn't get everything that we wanted, and that's fine. It's still on the table. We can talk about it later. Right, David? So am
yeah.
I.
Like,
thank you.
Like I said, welcome to the legislative process.
Who knows? He may be
sitting
upstairs.
Many things are proposed, and not everything happens here. So thank you all. I appreciate it. Move to adjourn.